NPR.
Hey, everyone. This is The Indicator from Planet Money. I'm Cardiff Garcia. The U.S. trade war with China and other countries. It's almost 2 years old now, and a combined hundreds of billions of dollars in tariffs have gone up since then. But the trade war has done something else, too. It's given a lot of business to lobbyists and lawyers who try to get exclusions to these new tariffs for the American companies that they represent. This has had a bad effect for the small businesses that can't afford to hire lobbyists, and the competition to be excluded from the trade war has led to some perverse economic consequences as well. These were the conclusions of a big new investigative report from Lydia DePillis, a reporter at ProPublica. Lydia, welcome back.
Hi.
This is like your beat, isn't it? Like
it is.
People trying to get excluded from the trade war.
Right. Ways around, up, over, through.
Up, over, through, avoiding all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. After the break, Lydia, you are going to tell us all about the conclusions in your report. And we're going to do it through the story of one particular small businessman who has really struggled with these tariffs.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. Carla Saavedra-Kahalski, director of conversational AI products, leads a team that helped design Eno, the intelligent assistant, with three questions in mind.
Are we being proactive? Are we giving you a really easy way to resolve something? And are we making sure that we're always doing it in the most empathetic way we can? Because we realize this is your money, and money is very personal.
Stay tuned after the episode to learn about how Carla and her team designed Eno to help customers save time during tax season with a charitable giving summary.
Okay, Lydia, I want to start with this. Who is Mike Elrod and what is Ecotemp?
Okay, so Mike Elrod is this guy I called up out of the blue. I found his letters in this big database that that you use to file for exemptions to tariffs. And he's a South Carolina businessman. 15 years ago, he found this product in China. It was a hot water heater. And he thought, wow, this would sell really well in the U.S. So this is the type of business that is very common in the U.S. You work with a Chinese manufacturer, you brand and design and develop a line of products, and then you market them all over the world. So he's done that, and that's what he sells.
So when the U.S. trade war started, how did it affect Ecotemp, his company?
So immediately they were slapped with 25% tariffs on everything that they import because it was all on that tariff list. So that came to hundreds of thousands of dollars, and this is a 12-person business. That's represents basically their entire profit margin.
How does he respond?
Well, he knows because the administration has said that we are going to set up a process that's going to help you guys. If you're a company that can only get this specific thing from China, if it's going to hurt you a lot to have to pay the tariffs, then we'll consider giving you an exemption. So he tries to figure it out himself. And he goes and writes a letter and says, "Dear Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, I can't get my water heaters anywhere other than China. It would be devastating to our company to have to get them anywhere else. So please give us a pass." Soon after that letter gets filed, Mike Elrod notices there another letter is filed on the docket, and it comes from one of his biggest competitors, a company called Rheem Manufacturing Company. They are owned by a Japanese private equity conglomerate. And they say, "Don't give this guy an exclusion because we get our hot water heaters from Japan, and all these other companies get them in these other countries. So it's totally possible for him to get them other in a place other than China. He doesn't deserve the exclusion."
And essentially what you have now is a small company competing against a very big company for how the U.S. government should favor one versus the other.
Sure. And so theoretically, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, which has dozens of people reviewing these exclusions, they have to make decisions on who to favor and who to disadvantage. And so Mike Elrod's exclusion request gets denied. And so then he figures maybe I could do it some other way, and he goes for more specific targeted exclusions on just the each model of water heater. And this time, more letters show up in the public docket opposing his request, and they come from a fancy D.C. law firm that Rheem is paying to write another letter going through all the case history and saying you still shouldn't give this guy exclusions. The next month, he's denied again.
Yeah, and I mean, I've got in my head this image of Mike Elrod, small businessman, by himself writing these letters to the U.S. Trade Representative, and his competitors are paying like a fancy D.C. law firm, which has connections to, you know, all of the players in D.C. and just seem to have an inbuilt advantage.
Yeah, I mean, specifically, one of the lawyers at this firm, King & Spalding, was the general counsel of the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative who set up the exclusion process.
And obviously, it seems like there's going to be an inherent advantage there because he knows all the people who work at the USTR and he knows the process by which they make
decisions.
He designed the process.
Yeah.
Seems unfair.
I mean, right. I mean, and the USTR will say, look, all of these are decided on the merits. It doesn't matter who's making the argument. And I do believe that the public servants who are reviewing these applications are not corrupt and that they are doing the best they can. But it's just an inherently impossible task to make objective. And also, no matter what decision they make, there's nothing you can do about it. There's no appeals process. There's no court to go bring it to. So
once the decision is made, that's pretty much it.
There's no accountability.
Yeah. I had one really strong reaction to your piece. As I read it, I was thinking, God, this is like a massive diversion of money and brain power and other kinds of resources to a kind of competition that exists only like in the legal realm. So it's like you don't have companies now competing on making the best product, on innovating. Instead, they're diverting all this money into lobbyists and law firms and stuff like that.
That's absolutely the story of the trade war. And it's not just the private sector, right? It's the government sector, too, having to write incredibly specific exemptions and decide whether something makes it or doesn't make it. That's really costly for our public servants.
Yeah. Something else you highlighted that, in fairness, is absolutely not unique to the Trump administration, which is that some people who at some point worked for the administration or for the president would go back into the lobbying industry. This seems to have really taken off in response to the trade war.
Yeah, I mean, so the revolving door has always been a thing. And I think it's more of a thing because the Trump administration is really hard to figure out and often has an audience of one, the president himself, right? So connections to him personally become that much more important and that much more valuable. So one case that came up in my story was that a medical device company called Varian Medical Systems, they hired this guy named Brian Ballard, who was Trump's lobbyist in Florida and also the chair of his inauguration committee, paid him more than $500,000. They got a meeting with Peter Navarro, who runs trade policy from the White House. Navarro says, look, I don't deal with exclusions. I put no thumbs on no scales for this company. But they did get almost all of their requests. And in an SEC filing to their investors said, this was worth to us $23 million that we didn't have to pay in tariffs. So it's a pretty good ROI.
It's a good investment.
It. Yeah.
Problem, of course, is that smaller companies or other lesser known companies might not be able to afford it.
Sure. I mean, if you know the folks in USTR, you can call them up and say, like, hey, are you sure you meant to do that? Can you look at it again?
Yeah. Nudge, nudge, nudge. That right. kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lydia, this is a fantastic piece of work. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
This podcast was produced by Darius Rafieyan, edited by Patty Hirsch. The Indicator is a production of NPR.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One.
My name is Carla Saavedra-Kohalski. My team is responsible for creating all of the customer-facing experiences for Eno, our intelligent assistant from Capital One. Customers have a lot on their plate. We want to kind of like take the mental load or at least carry some of the mental load our customers have when thinking about their finances and in thinking about their spending. One of the places where we see our customers spending a lot of time and effort is getting ready for tax season. So instead of having our customers go through their transactions and pick out the charitable giving that they did all year, Eno looks through your transactions to find where you've made donations and sends it in a great list via email. It saves our customers time and effort, which is a key tenet of Eno and a key tenet of having a great assistant.
To meet Eno, the Capital One assistant, go to capitalone.com/Eno.